Thank you for coming to session 112. This is titled...
Please use the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry about that.
Get very close to it.
Okay. This is titled, A Crisis of Perception, New Paradigms to Address the Complexities of Modern Mormonism. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off, and those attending will be respectful and attentive. This session will be recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine. You get 7 issues for the price of 6. They also say here to consider purchasing Skull Candy official headphones, customized just for Sunstones. I don't know what that's about. In all honesty, but and then it says, don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom, hosted by Benchmark Books. If you purchase books, it will help support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of the time that we've talked about, and we'll take care of that. Mormonism has inherited ways of thinking that are no longer sufficient to understand or address the complexities facing the 21st century church. Concepts from cybernetics, systems theory, and complex thought will be presented as alternative lenses with which to view and wrestle with the church's increased historical transparency, gender concerns, and racial diversity, as well as LGBTQIA issues and member disaffection. It will be argued that the movement towards circular epistemology that promotes awareness of interconnections allows for complexity and encourages tolerance for ambiguity, and that will infuse more compassion, hope, and inclusion into our communities and inspire more creative approaches to addressing current challenges. Our presenter will be Julie Hanks, who's a seasoned psychotherapist and the owner of Wasatch Family Therapy, author of The Burnout Cure and The Assertiveness Guide for Women. She's also a media contributor, performing songwriter, and blogs about Mormon culture and emotional health. She earned her MSW in clinical social work and PhD in marriage and family therapy, with an emphasis in creative systematic studies. I'm, by the way, Tom McAfee, and I teach at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And I'll turn the time over to Julie.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you so much for being here and for putting up with the tech delay here. And my notes are not showing on the screen, so I'm a little fragmented here. And I wish this were wireless, because I'm a performer. I want to walk around. Can I use that wireless mic?
Maybe you could. May as well be assertive about this.
We are not going to start with a song, though. I want to be a window. Okay. Oh, I have to say, I read this in preparation, you know, the abstract that I submitted, and I just thought, well, I just bit off a lot. So this could be like a, month-long convention, and we have 60 minutes, so I will not deliver on all of these promises, but my hope is to open up a conversation about these, some ways that we can rethink some of the issues facing us today. What we need is a deep reexamination of our culture, a rejection of those conceptual models that have outlived their usefulness. As I was working on my PhD and studying systems theory and cybernetics, I often thought about the church as a system and about the gospel and how tied the concepts are to our culture. We have let's just define some terms. Crisis is an unstable or crucial time or state of affairs in which a decisive change is pending. And that's how Mormonism feels to me right now. We are in this transformational period, and we have some decisive change that is impending. Perception is a way that we think or make sense of something using our senses. Paradigm is a cognitive framework that helps us organize or interpret information. And the definition of complexity is the state of having many parts and being difficult to understand or find an answer to. And there seems to be a lot of complexity and things that are difficult to understand in what we're facing right now in modern Mormonism. And then definition, we're going to be talking about epistemology, which is ways that we know, or the study of knowledge. And we know by drawing a distinction between this or that. It enables us to create physical boundaries, functional groupings, conceptual distinctions. The language that embodies particular culture's framework of reality. So our reality of Mormonism is informed by the paradigms that we have inherited and the language that we have, which I propose is insufficient to wrestle with the difficult issues we face. Each word creates something else from which it is being distinguished. Language is our epistemological knife. It divides up our world into chunks for the purposes of knowing about them. Immersed in the flow of language, we don't realize that we create the similarities and differences, and we relate to those similarities and differences as if they were not made by us. Objects, events, and issues appear as we name them. So, paradigms that we have inherited are the mechanistic, well, they're from outdated physics, and I know that a therapist has no business talking about physics, but I'm going to venture, so you can correct me, those of you who are physicists. So we've inherited a way of knowing that is mechanistic. So the world is a machine. People are machines. And if you reduce it to the smallest part, that's how you get to know it. Lineal epistemology, this causes this. So we think in terms of lines, and I'm proposing we change to think in terms of recursive circles. We think in terms of individuals, atomistic, right? You can't reduce it anymore. Well, we've learned with quantum physics you can reduce an atom, and that... the natural world does not behave how we thought it did, and individuals are unpredictable as well. And then classical science, we've inherited this notion of objectivity, and what systems theory and cybernetics, second order cybernetics in particular, say there is no objectivity. Everything is said by someone, and that informs whatever we're seeing and making sense of. And then to know something, we've inherited this way, we reduce it to a small part, simplify it. The more simple, the more true it is. And then we, particularly Mormons, are in love with certainty, right? I know the church is true, right? It's not okay to say, I hope, I believe, I choose to believe. So the proposed paradigms we're going to hopefully get to are the idea of a creative universe, knowing things through circular epistemology, spirals, interconnections, not lines, through understanding systems and processes. This is a big one that I include in a lot of my blog articles, but self-reflexivity, being able to think about what we're experiencing and reflect on it while we're experiencing it. Complexity. We don't like complexity, but I think understanding complexity a little bit more as a people will help us. And then ambiguity and paradox can be helpful, more helpful than a sense of certainty. So here are some examples of the complex issues, gender issues. What is the role of women in the priesthood, LGBT Mormons, where is their place, racial diversity and worldwide church? Well, how come the leadership doesn't reflect the diversity of the church? Increased historical transparency, for example. Oh, there are 7 versions of the first vision. Wait a second. That is not what I was taught in primary. Joseph Smith married a 14-year-old. Okay, that's so. We're being thrown entering into this phase where our family secrets are out. You know, in every family system, in a healthy system, if there are secrets, eventually they come out, and the family can transform and reorganize. I feel like that's what's happening in Mormonism. We're having to get more. Think in terms of complexity and ambiguity. And then member disaffection. So people resigning their membership or saying, I can't participate in this anymore. So there are a lot of pressing issues that we are facing. Disturbingly, during times of transition, complexity, uncertainty are faced with potential or actual chaos. There is a tendency to seek out absolute foundations, certainty, simplicity, and a framework that will make sense of the world and reduce our anxiety. These frameworks are informed by reductionistic and dualistic thinking that drastically reduce the complexity of the world. And that's a quote from Alfonso Monturi, who, if you're not familiar with, is a brilliant philosopher and writer based out of Northern California. But this seems to be happening in Mormonism. This, like, we want to keep it the way, let's just keep it the way it was. Let's not talk about that. Or there are people like, you know, I can't simplify this. This is not simple anymore. So I'd like your help coming up with some examples of how the outdated paradigms are informing conversations and how we engage in talking about or addressing difficult issues. These are some examples that I have come up with, but I would love to hear your ideas. And I guess I have your mic, so maybe I'll run around and give it to you. So reductionism, I see this all the time by labeling large groups of people as, you know, true blue Mormon or those intellectuals or those feminists or, oh, they're just blind followers or they're apostate. So we apply labels to people as if those labels were accurate descriptions of a person. So we reduce groups to this one-dimensional aspect. We also view sin very individualistically, is that a word? Instead of recognizing the interconnection and the systemic the systemic factors that impact our behavior. So we talk about agency as if it's just you can choose whatever you want and there's nothing else impacting our choices. And we know in reality that's not true. I mean, we do have agency and there are lots of other factors that influence our choices. Othering, us versus them, right? Are you in or are you out? Are you in the boat or are you out of the boat? Kind of dividing and othering, and it happens every flavor of Mormonism. I see it. Either or thinking, you know, the only true church, the only, which I'm like, we're not the only church with truth. So what does that actually mean? I'm not sure. Any ideas of how reductionism is showing up in our culture? The price is right.
That's why I went on car or vacation. Okay, so one thing that I struggle with, that it doesn't seem to be as talked about now as it used to be, but the symbolism of it being a battle or a war, it's kind of a traumatic place to worship from. And if it's, like you said, all in or all out, everything's black and white, all or none, and it's this battle that we're fighting, which means we're the right and everybody else is wrong, and there's only going to be one loser, and we already know that's Satan, so pick your side. And you only have agency as far as, it's like a mother picking two outfits for a child and saying you can pick either one. Well, they're both good choices, so it's good, but it doesn't really allow us to exercise our agency and really have questions. You know, we sing our hymns, and it's about the battle and fighting and how, I don't know, it's frustrating because it's not talked about. The emphasis is not on what we have in common and pure truths that we all share and aspire to and the goodness in all people. It feels more like a war and a battle, and that's hard for me.
Thank you. That's a great point. Are you coming to my 2 o'clock? Okay, because we're going to talk a lot about that. Was there another? Yeah.
The one that really chilled me was somebody that can't handle this 14-year-old marriage or something like that, somehow is transformed into something like a disciple of the devil. And, boy, that is so chilling, you know. I mean, if you got, most of us have family people that are there.
So on the other side, I have an in-law who's got serious health problems to the point thinks about suicide and what's the point of it all. And every time I talk to him, he goes, I can only believe in black and white. And did you listen to Holland's last talk? He only said the true church. He didn't say the one and only true church. And he counts them in the ensign. He says, we're losing our whole faith. And I say, no, that's actually a good thing. But you know, there is another side to people like that, too. So I have to, like, be sympathetic to both sides.
Yeah. Well, from a developmental standpoint, we've all been there. That concrete black and white thinking is part of all development. And I think it's been historically part of our development as a people. And it's not to judge people who are holding on to old ways of thinking. We all do that. We all resist change. So thank you so much for that, Chris, my cousin there. Mm-hmm. So what about examples of linearity, lineal epistemology? I see that in blame, like this caused this. Well, because they did this, or because you did this, I did this. So it's just, there's no acknowledgement of co-creation of relationships. Mechanistic thinking, the formulaic gospel, if I do this, then I will get blessings, and blessings feel good. And if I do this and I don't get blessed, it's because I've sinned. And just kind of very formulaic. Mechanistic thinking, the church is perfect. It's set in motion like a perfect machine, and there's, you know, how dare you say it's not. We talked about certainty, dualistic thinking, right? If you question the LGBT policy, you're not supporting the brethren. Or are you a working or a stay-at-home mom? Like those are, you have to pick one or the other. You cannot be loyally opposed to the church. There was a blog article and that was the title. It's like, really? Okay. Maybe you can't, but... This is another great quote. Now, there's a paradigm of a creative universe which recognizes the progressive, innovative character of physical processes. The new paradigm emphasizes the collective, cooperative, and organizational aspects of nature. Its perspective is synthetic and holistic rather than analytic and reductionist. So the idea of a creative universe, as we'll see, is there's a lot of scripture to back that up. So what we need are these new ways to think about our faith. Systems thinking. So just a basic definition, a system is a group of interacting, interdependent elements or agents that form a complex whole and exist in an environment. So every system in your body, every person is part of a family, every family is part of a community. So it's this ecological, interconnected view. Kind of like that. Don't look at it too long. Okay, so in systems theory, there's just some key concepts. It offers us a new language rather than the reductionistic, linear way to think about things. It originated in biology, but has become transdisciplinary. So you can talk about systems across all different disciplines. It's focused on interrelations and interactions, not things. So it acknowledges that we draw distinctions between things, but those are all part of a process. We have to name them to categorize them and understand them, but we can't talk about them as if they actually exist. Does that make sense? Kind of? No. Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. Systems theory was initially focused on order and equilibrium, self-organization. That is coordination that arises spontaneously from local interactions, and it's a way of kind of reorganizing. And I was thinking of an example of this, and if you'll recall, was it in the 90s? President Hunter was giving going to give a talk at BYU for a devotional, and a man came in demanding that he read a document. Do you remember this? And the whole, spontaneously, people started singing, "We Thank Thee, O God, for a Prophet." Right? That wasn't directed like, okay, now we're gonna all sing, but that was an example of self-organization. Like the little individual people were like, that's their response to the crisis. So that's an example of that. And there are closed systems that do not interact with the environment, according to systems theory, and open systems. As we'll find out, everything is a closed and an open system. It's a tree, and I gotta find my note here. This is to remind me about, oh, yes, there was some scientists who were decided to take all the leaves off of a tree and see what happened. Kind of mean, but and it's secreted an increased amount of sap and also this anti-parasitic agent because it thought it had been attacked by a parasite, which it had, but it was a human, not a bug. Well, I guess same thing in their mind. But what happened is that the trees of the same variety surrounding it also secreted that parasitic agent, even though they were not attacked, right? So that is a great example of how everything is interconnected, even if it's not physically touching, that we are all connected. There it is. So open and closed system, this is just an illustration of that. And as we go on, we'll find out that everything is both. Okay, so integrating systems theory and information theory is cybernetics. And it was coined by Norbert Wiener, I hope it's Wiener, coined the term in 1954. And he defined it as control and communication in the animal and the machine. And he said, to control is to communicate, and to communicate is to control. This is attributed to someone sending it in a letter, you know, use the word cybernetics because nobody will know what it means. This will always put you in advantage in arguments. So I remember when I'm writing the abstract for this, I'm like, I put in cybernetics, people think I'm really smart, you know? It's like, what is that? Is that, yes? Information, yes, well, okay. I'm sorry, Claude. You're just not the highlight of this part of the talk. Thank you. I told you it's dangerous for a therapist to enter into these kind of conversations. So what is cybernetics? Gregory Bateson says it's the study of form and pattern, a branch of mathematics dealing with problems of control, recursiveness, and information. Beer said it's the science of effective organization. Van Forster said, should one name one central concept, a first principle of cybernetics would be circularity. Klaus said, the theory of interconnectedness of possible dynamic self-regulated systems with their subsystems. So everybody clear? Like, I studied this for 3 years and I'm like, I feel it more than I can explain it. So just a summary, cybernetics is about focusing on process and navigation, the study of pattern, the science of organization, circularity, interconnectedness, and recursive feedback loops. So hopefully that's a little bit more. So this is a great example of recursion. And this is, how do I say this right? Ouroboros, anybody know? And this is, so a serpent eating its own tail, which it just keeps going. I mean, we have a lot of imagery in Mormon theology about circle, well, and pop songs written by my dad. The circle of our love is more than, just, okay. We randomly break into song in our family, and that's normal, but I realize it's not normal here, so I will tone it down. So this represents cyclicality, the end in the beginning, a symbol of eternal unity. So this is what we're talking about when we're talking about circular recursion. All right. Now that we don't understand cybernetics, we're going to talk about the cybernetics of cybernetics, which to me, or second-order cybernetics, this is actually really important and easy to get for me. It's the movement of studying observed systems to studying observing systems. So basically, it's the inclusion of the observer in inquiry. And like we mentioned earlier, that the knower cannot be left out of the equation. There is no objectivity, and everything is said by somebody, and any statement tells us more about the person saying it than what they're actually describing or talking about. So the including the observer in the system. So Edgar Morin is a French philosopher who's not very well known in the U.S., because a lot of his work has not been translated, but the work that has been translated is amazing. I mean, I rarely read books like five times, especially if they're this kind of stuff, but it's really worth looking into. But he has developed what is called complex thought, and he integrates ideas from systems theory, information theory, cybernetics, to develop a method or a path of thinking that I think is really can be really helpful for us as we face complexity. Complex thought refers to a pattern of organizing knowledge that is circular, recursive, relational, and to hold both the whole and the part of a system. So he criticized systems theory because it went from individualism to holism, which is still a reduction in a way. He's saying no, it's the whole and the part. Complex thought is an attempt to develop a method or path that does not mutilate, fragment, abstract, or reduce, but allows for holding uncertainty and ambiguity. A key element in complex thought is a shift from disjunctive binary oppositions, like science, art, order, disorder, whole part, to both and. Think about if we as a people could think that way. That just opens up a lot of possibilities. There are three meta-principles that Morin talks about that I think are really, really helpful. The dialogic principle conceives of complementarity of antagonisms, such as the relationship between organization and disorder, order and disorder. So, yeah, this stuff like sometimes blows my mind, and I can't even believe I'm trying to describe it. but so, things are at the same time complementary and antagonistic. And we'll hopefully go into some examples. Organizational recursion is that society, the idea that society produces the individuals that produce the society, we are at the same time products and producers of our culture. Another example is a whirlpool. Think about a whirlpool. It's a product and a producer of itself at the same time. And with reproduction, we are the result of processes before us, and now we're reproduced, and now we become producers of the process that continues. Yeah. I've read this book 5 times, and I'm like, now what does he mean by that again? Holographic principle. I think this is really helpful, I think. A hologram image contains the quasi-totality of information in the represented object. So example is DNA. Each cell contains the totality of the genetic information. Right? So if you think about that, you know, we contain God in us, we contain the universe, we contain each other in us, it's that really changes how we view ourselves and other people and our interactions. Just Teresa DeFeo, a quote here, what is the hologram principle? It is merely the overstepping of the illusion of retaining ourselves disconnected to the chain of life, the overstepping of the illusion that we are dominators of objects, exactly like a hologram where every single part experiences the totality of being together. Man must never lose sight of the awareness of carrying the history of the entire universe within himself and must never stop knowing that every I carries a we inside of it. I mean, if we could just take that last sentence and really live that in our lives and in our culture, that there is no me. I mean, there is me and you're in me. We're integrally connected. A couple of other aspects of complex thought that I think are really helpful is that action is a wager that escapes our intention. So think about agency. A lot of this really applies. So once we act, it goes into this world of all of these interactions. And he says, you know, if there's a stable environment, let's think of a computer, you can use a program for that. But in a living system, you have to use a strategy, which is being able to envision a number of outcomes and scenarios and then modify it as you go. And I see some movement toward this in the church, moving from program, maybe correlation, to more, you know, understanding the basic core. Complexity requires strategy. You can't apply the idea of a program. All right. So just some scriptural basis for this conversation. For the creative universe, God talks about himself as a creator. Moses 2:27, and I, God, created man in mine own image. In the image of my only begotten created I him, male and female created I them. Also, the power of language in the creation process, for Jacob 4:9, for behold, by the power of his word, man came upon the face of the earth, which earth was created by the power of his word. So language, kind of going back to what we were talking about in the beginning, language is part of creation. Cybernetic epistemology reminds me of I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. There are a lot of references to circularity in Scripture. All in D&C 38:1-2, the last line, all things are present before mine eyes. DNC 35.1, my course is one eternal round. So there's a lot of references to God's view as circular and not linear. Systems and process thinking, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. So they're connected. If I do it to you, it's connected to Christ. If ye are one, ye are not mine, DNC 38:27. So we are connected. So these are scriptures pointing to interconnection. 1 Corinthians 12:12, for as the body is one and hath many members, and all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. So this is saying, you know, we are separate and we're connected. We're both. Some scriptures that point to self-reflexivity as an approach. Cast Luke 6:42, cast out first the beam out of thine own eye, and then thou shalt see clearly to pull out the mote that is in thy brother's eye. Right? Look inside. Reflect on your experience. And then 2 Nephi 32:1, and now behold, my beloved brethren, I suppose that ye ponder somewhat in your hearts. So pondering, ideas of kind of waiting on the Lord conjure up images for me of reflecting on self, not projecting or blaming other people. Some scriptural support for complex thought. Isaiah 55:9. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts. So Christ is saying, you're not going to understand this. You're not going to understand everything. And yet we think, well, we have to know. We have to have the answers now. Let's see, Isaiah 28:9-10. Precept must be upon precept. So we learn. Oh no, here we go. Line upon line, precept on precept. That is how we, Okay. I know, I can't believe I'm doing that. And then I'm, okay, ambiguity. Well, so we find paradox and things that are difficult to understand all through the scriptures. Matthew 16:25, for whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. So if you lose your life, you find your life. What, the last shall be first. You know, ye are less than the dust of the earth. That's Helaman 12:7. And we're also, Moses 1:3, the work and the glory of God. Like, we're both? What? Which are we? So it's interesting that highly creative individuals have paradoxical qualities. And I did my dissertation on supporting creative productivity of mothers. And when I read this, and if anybody knows how to say Chek Mihaly, I've read all his books and I don't know how to say his name. But so it's this idea that what we think are opposites exist in the same individual, and those people tend to be highly creative. And I thought, wow, if we are born to be creators, then this is really important for us to be able to hold seemingly opposing ideas, feelings, qualities at the same time. Because that, I read this and I was like, oh my gosh, I have a diagnosis. I'm a highly creative person. Like, it's so great. Yeah, masculine and feminine. So like integration of paradox seems to be an important part of creativity. I'm trying to find my place here, you guys. Thank you. Okay. So I would like now to give you back the microphone so you can do your solo, or you can ask questions and talk about how these concepts might transform our discussions and how we think about and talk about the complex issues that we face. So I'm going to put this over here. I'd love to hear your comments, and I learn by conversation. And any questions or comments must be sung.
Yeah, I was. This is more of a question. I'm not sure. I wasn't sure where you thought on these kind of moving to new paradigms, etc. Where you think that the church culture, the church institutionally is. I'm personally, particularly on some of these issues, discouraged that there, you know, the movement in the changing world. That there's a fragmentation, you leave or you stay, and that the institutional, the active church in some way seems to be becoming more conservative. I don't know. I don't know where you stand. Do you think we're moving to more complex thought as an institution?
I think that the current crises are a path for us to move that direction. I see little bits of it happening, and I choose to be hopeful. And I'm also discouraged, but I choose to focus more on the hopefulness and kind of finding ways to help myself move along on that path of thinking about things differently. So I think there is some change, and also large systems. It takes a lot to make fundamental changes. And so I'm willing to be patient.
And I would like to ask a question that does touch on your own personal experience, because 16 years ago, as a closeted gay teenager sitting in EFY, listening to you perform, I never expected to then have you present as a doctor in cybernetic processes.
What does it? Come on.
So if you could speak to maybe any personal experience in that interim period that may have led to this, you know, very interesting situation, I would really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Great question. Is this on? Okay. I was not expecting that. So there was no interim. It's all an evolving process of my personal development of spirituality, thought, life. And a few years ago, well, it was probably 5-6 years ago now, I stumbled on this program, PhD in Marriage and Family Therapy, with an emphasis in creative systemic cybernetic studies. I'm like, I have no idea, but, you know, it sounds cool. And it had creative in it. So, but all, it was just kind of the next phase of development for me. While I was doing EFY CDs, I was also getting my master's, having a family, performing, practicing as a psychotherapist, and really trying to find my own way through the cultural stuff. And so this, I guess I'm excited about your comment and your question, because that means I'm evolving and I'm becoming more complex. So thank you. Any other comments or questions?
Hi, I really, really appreciate your presentation and this set of ideas.
Thank you.
I mean, it seems to me that the church as an institution is really insulated from feedback. That's part of my experience in the last year. Within my ward, there's tremendous resistance to some of the recent policy announcements, and our state president encouraged us to write, and they sent something back, and we've never heard anything. I don't know if the sense we get is that there is no feedback, and without a feedback loop, things don't adjust, evolve. Don't evolve. Mm-hmm. And to me, that means we have to continue to try to do that if we want to stay engaged. The other thing I would say on the bottom one is that for self-reflection, it's so easy to default to the categories, to the ways of thinking that we've been presented with by the church. And to know yourself requires to really find out what you yourself are thinking and have your own experience and base the feedback that you give to the people around you on genuine self-reflection. And I encourage us all to continue to do that.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I want to clarify that these are not unique to the Mormon Church. I mean, this is Western thought. So I'm just applying it to how I see it today in Mormonism. So just want to clarify that. Yes.
I have a question. First of all, maybe a little bit of a statement. So excited to be here today as a closeted in Orem person who has been understanding this not through that complex of a system, but the non-dualistic, dualistic type of thinking. Everything belongs. We all belong, wanting everyone to feel like they're included and belong. How do we start these conversations when realistically we're in rooms full of people at church who are at such different stages of development and levels? Mm-hmm. How, that's been my struggle. I can do it one-on-one usually, but how do we start the conversations? Do you have any ideas?
I have some ideas, and I'd love to hear your ideas. I think speaking up, just saying, like when you're thinking, wow, there's a different way to think about this. For example, in a recent Relief Society class, I raised my hand and I said, you know, I just have to be honest, I'm really uncomfortable with how we're talking about this, because it was about bringing in the lost sheep. Because I said, you know, what I found to be effective is not to preach, but to listen and to actually hear, you know. So just kind of saying where you are in a compassionate way, not going, oh, you know, there's another example of those closed-minded, you know, but like they are us, the institutional church is in us and we're in it, and so compassionately just saying where you are in a way that allows for the other person to be where they are, but opens up kind of a door. And what I found is when I'm willing to speak up, people will come and go, wait, now tell me more about, you know, and then it kind of opens up more conversations. And I think the internet is so great for that, being able to share different viewpoints. That's why I one of the reasons I started blogging on Mormon cultural issues, I'm like, you know, I can write to the brethren, or I can, you know, have a million members of the church read a blog article on modesty, and that may actually, in people's lives, make an impact like it would from the, not like it would, you know what I'm saying? Okay. Yes.
What you were saying about sort of opening the discussion, I found, I live in Seattle, so being Mormon in Seattle is kind of fun. No one understands why you don't drink coffee. Ever. Ever. What's fascinating is, so opening that conversation and providing room for that conversation, I was part of a church focus group, I think, 2 years ago, which was utterly surreal. Like
feedback. That's good to know,
Like it was genuinely amazing. They called about 10 different people from our stake and had us sit in a room, and it was people from all walks of life, all different backgrounds. And what was genuinely fascinating was these people who I'd always thought of as very black and white Mormons, given the opportunity, like we had like a board with like, what are positives of the church and what are negatives of the church? And like, I watched women who I'd always sort of dismissed as very, having very simple
Molly.
Testimonies. Yeah, like I was just very like judgmental of them, but they would just be like, well, women have no power in the church and like da da da. And I was just like, holy heck. Like, or someone said something, and then someone went, well, no, women have power in the primary. And I looked at her, and she went, okay, women have no power in the church. Like, it was genuinely shocking to me. Like, there is so much room for that conversation to happen. It may not happen in Relief Society or in Sunday school, mm-hmm. but if you it's scary and it's intimidating and you might get a lot of glares from a lot of old ladies. But if you open your mouth and say something, you open the conversation. You might take the hit socially, but it's worth it so much for that one person who comes up to you afterwards and says, you know, I've always really had a problem with that. Like, there's such a fear of being vocally discordant that if you provide that space, people want those conversations. They really do.
Right. And let's go. Amen. Woo. And piggybacking on one of your points, I think, it's easy to have the belief, we can't talk about this at church. Mormons are so close-minded in my ward. You are a close-minded Mormon in your ward. They're in you. You're in them. So we just go to that reductionism just so automatically, right? Instead of they're me, I'm them, and I'm going to share me, share you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And very much about the reductionism, not just on a systems level, but on the individual level. Lots of my friends and family.
Closer to the mic.
Lots of my friends and family have had some trouble with church recently. They themselves have all these characteristics because they are Mormon. They cannot differentiate themselves and their identity from the religion. So when they find out some base elements aren't right, they feel that they have to play that role of being on the other side. And when you try and talk to them, you're trying to say, you do realize you are still reacting in the framework you were given.
Right.
You don't have to be an auntie anymore. You don't have to. I mean, do you find this when you're in your... I don't expect you to share any specific stories, but as you're counseling, do you find people can grow to learn to see the framework that they're in?
Yes. Yes. That's a great point. And it's all over the place. And again, it's not Mormonism. It's just... Mormonism was reborn into Western American thought, and so we've kind of imported that all everywhere we go. So yes, and that's the ability to think dialectically is a huge part of the work that I do with everybody, but particularly my LDS clients, being able to hold both and. Let me just share a quick experience. I have a 9-year-old. And she, this was a few months ago, she was able to say, Mom, I really, really, really want to do this, and I'm really, really scared, but I was like, wow, way to go. Like, being able to hold these seemingly opposing feelings and thoughts, and that's the kind of, it's not that hard if my 9-year-old can do it. It's just we're so entrenched in one way of thinking that it makes it hard to even see, and which is part of why I wanted to do this presentation, because it's helped me to reflect on how I know things and to question how I know what I know, which has opened up a lot more flexibility in my approach to life. Thank you for that. Yes.
I think we make assumptions about our leaders that they are all on the same page. I can't imagine anything approaching whole souls, unanimous agreement among, let's just start with those 15 men. With regard to the recent addition to the handbook, speaking of the LGBT members, I have heard that in the First Presidency and Quorum of the 12 meeting, there is lots of discussion. I wonder, once the president of the church makes a decision on a question, I wonder how much some of the brethren who are perhaps saddened and heartsick at this new handbook edition with regard to the LGBT families and same-sex parents. There are many of us who are saddened by that. Greg Prince once said, continuous revelation means change, so get used to it. I don't think I'm going to give live long enough for the change I long for on this particular issue. But I can't help but feel that in our leadership there are people who really feel the same way I do. But perhaps are hesitant to speak very strongly about that. So
yeah, that's, and again, it's there's diversity and there's unity, and those have to work together. And that's a great example of there's going to be diversity and unity in that group, just like there is everywhere else.
This will need to be our last
question.
Speaker, go ahead.
What he just said may be true. I've heard things that maybe there are some of the top leaders of the church who did not want to do this, but they're willing to throw the entire LGBT community and all the people who love them under the bus for the sake of their own power and to hold up a false unanimity if there isn't really unanimity. And I have really come to think that those who don't want this but who go along with it anyway are almost worse than the ones who promulgated it, because they're cowards in that they won't speak up and do what it takes to not let this kind of crap take place.
Thank you.